Money Psychology. Money Psychology.
Every time you reach for your wallet, check your bank balance, or make a financial decision, you're not just dealing with money. You're reliving every money lesson, fear, and belief you absorbed before you were old enough to understand what any of it meant. I'm Elliot Graves, and this is Money Psychology, where we explore how your earliest financial experiences created the money mindset that controls your financial life today. Welcome to Money Psychology.
Money Psychology.
You know, there's a question that I think sits at the heart of so many of our financial lives, and we rarely stop to ask it out loud.
What's that?
What if the job title on your business card is secretly writing the rules for how you spend, save, and even stress about money?
That's powerful.
It's something I've had to confront directly in my own life. Working in a creative industry, you know, it's a world of extremes. It's feast or famine. One moment you're celebrating a success, and the next you're facing a long stretch of uncertainty with no guaranteed paycheck. That kind of volatility, it doesn't just affect your bank account, it burrows into your brain. It fundamentally changes your relationship with risk and security.
And it's fascinating, because my own path was the polar opposite.
I started in a very structured, predictable corporate world. The security of that biweekly paycheck was the foundation of everything. But that very security creates its own kind of financial mirage, doesn't it? It can lull you into a certain kind of behavior, a different set of assumptions that aren't always challenged.
Exactly.
The freelancer and the salaried employee, the entrepreneur taking massive risks, and the civil servant building a stable pension. These aren't just jobs, they're psychological training grounds for our financial habits.
And that is precisely what we're here to explore today.
We're stepping into what we're calling the financial mirage to decode the profound and often invisible impact our career choices have on our money behavior.
We're going to delve into how the very nature of your profession, its stability, its satisfaction, its inherent pressures, can reinforce the money scripts you learned as a child, or force you to write entirely new ones.
This is a conversation that promises to connect the dots between your desk and your wallet in ways you might never have considered before.
And that mirage you mentioned, it's so powerful.
For me, in that creative space, the lack of a steady paycheck created a kind of financial hypervigilance. Every dollar that came in felt like it had to do the work of 10. It wasn't just for today's bills. It was a buffer against an unknown number of future unpaid months.
See, that's fascinating, because for me, the biweekly paycheck did the opposite. It created a kind of financial numbness. It almost removed the need for that vigilance. You knew, with absolute certainty, that more was coming. So the dollar you spent today didn't feel as precious, because its replacement was already scheduled to arrive.
Did that ever feel like a trap? That predictability?
Oh,
profoundly. It's the classic golden handcuffs scenario, but it's more subtle than that. It's not just about the salary being too good to leave. It's that the rhythm of that salary dictates the rhythm of your life. Your mortgage payments, your car lease, your subscriptions, they all sync up to that predictable flow. The idea of disrupting that flow becomes terrifying. It feels less like stepping off a path and more like stepping off a cliff.
Yes. And it's the inverse for a freelancer.
The goal is to create a rhythm out of chaos. You're trying to smooth out these massive peaks and valleys of income into something that resembles a stable life. So when a big check does come in, there's this huge internal battle. Part of you wants to celebrate, to finally breathe and release all that pent-up stress,
and the other part is screaming, "Don't touch it. That has to last you 6 months."
Exactly. The money is never just money, it's time. You're constantly calculating how much runway each project buys you. It changes the very nature of what a dollar represents. It's not a unit of spending power, it's a unit of survival time.
That must have a huge impact on your ability to plan for the long term.
I mean, when your focus is just on the next 6 months of runway, how do you even begin to think about retirement, which is 40 years down the road?
It It makes it abstract. It feels like a luxury problem. The immediate concern, the very real and present risk, is running out of cash next quarter. So you might delay retirement savings, or you might make much more conservative choices when you do invest, because you can't stomach the thought of losing a single dollar of that hard-won buffer. Which is the great paradox, isn't it? My world, the corporate one, was ostensibly about minimizing risk. The whole structure is designed for stability, but that stability can encourage a different kind of risky behavior, lifestyle inflation. Because the money is predictable, the spending becomes predictable, the small luxuries become necessities, and before you know it, that comfortable salary feels tight, not because your needs have changed, but because your wants have slowly, imperceptibly crystallized into perceived needs. That phrase you just used, crystallized into perceived needs, that is so precise. Because in the freelance world, the fear is that your wants will sabotage your needs. You live in this state of delayed gratification. The want, the nice dinner, the vacation, is always pitted against the need, which is that runway, that survival time. And in the corporate world, the lines just blur. There's no negotiation. It's a slow, quiet merger. The business class flight for work becomes the reason you can't fly economy for leisure. The client dinners at nice restaurants set a new standard for your personal nights out. It's not even a conscious decision. It just happens. The environment recalibrates your definition of normal. Is that about the environment, or is it about the identity that the job gives you? You know, the feeling that you are the person who flies business class, that you've earned it, that it's part of the package. Oh, it's 100% about identity. It's performance. You're performing the role of a successful manager, a successful executive, and that performance has a costume. It has props, the right watch, the right car, the right neighborhood. The spending isn't just for you. It's a signal to your peers, your superiors, your subordinates. It communicates that you belong. That sounds exhausting. It's like you can never take the costume off. Well, and the scariest part is, after a while, you forget you're even wearing one. It just feels like your skin. You internalize it. I remember getting a raise, and my first thought wasn't, great, I can save more for retirement. It was, okay, now I can finally afford the club membership that everyone at my level seems to have. Wow. So the next goalpost is immediately presented to you by the culture. It's not even presented. It's just there. It's the ambient pressure. And if you resist it, you risk being seen as, well, as not a team player, as someone who doesn't get it. It's subtle, but it's powerful. Did you feel a version of that? A pressure to spend in a certain way, to maintain your creative identity? That's a great question. It's different. The pressure isn't to signal wealth, it's to signal creativity or, authenticity. So maybe you're not buying a luxury car, but you're spending a lot on experiences. Traveling to an obscure location for inspiration. Buying the artisan-made tools, you know, investing in the narrative of being a creative person. It's a different costume, but it's a costume nonetheless. So, it's still a form of lifestyle inflation, just disguised as personal growth or artistic necessity. Mm-hmm. And it's just as dangerous, because you can justify it so easily. This isn't a frivolous purchase, it's an investment in my craft. But at the end of the day, the bank account doesn't know the difference between an investment in your craft and a down payment on a boat. And that's the core of the mirage, isn't it? Both paths create these incredibly compelling stories that justify our financial behaviors. My story was about stability, success, and climbing a ladder. Yours was about artistry, freedom, and feeding the muse. But both stories can lead you to the exact same place, trapped by a set of financial expectations you didn't even realize you'd signed up for. And when you put it like that, it's a little terrifying, isn't it? That two roads that look so wildly different, one paved with predictable paychecks, the other a chaotic dirt path, can lead to the same destination, a place where you're not really in control. That's the heart of it. The illusion of control is the most dangerous part of the mirage. The corporate person thinks they're in control because of the stability, and the creative thinks they're in control because of their freedom. But in reality, Both are just reacting to the pressures of a role they've adopted. So, what's the way out? I mean, we can't just quit our jobs to escape the psychology they impose on us. How do you start to separate your true financial self from the professional costume you've been wearing for years? I don't think it's a dramatic act. It's not about throwing the costume in a bonfire. I think it starts with a tiny bit of curiosity. The next time you're about to make a purchase that feels tied to your job, whether it's the right laptop for a creative or the right club membership for an executive, you just pause and ask yourself what? Why am I buying this? Even simpler, you ask, who is buying this? Is it you? Or is it the senior manager? Is it the struggling artist? Just creating that little bit of distance, that moment of observation, can be revolutionary. It's the first step to seeing the mirage for what it is. That's really powerful. It's not about shame or judgment. It's just about awareness, acknowledging that there might be another force at the steering wheel. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. You do. And that's when you can start making a different choice. Maybe you still buy the thing, but you buy it consciously. You own the decision instead of letting the costume make it for you. And that small shift is how you begin to reclaim your financial identity. So it seems the ultimate lesson, whether you're dealing with feast or famine, with a slow creep of lifestyle inflation, is that the most important financial skill isn't budgeting or investing. It's self-interrogation. It's knowing who you are, separate from what you do for a living. And that is a conversation that goes so much deeper than just money. Thank you, as always, for the exploration. Thank you. It's been a fascinating one. To everyone listening, we hope this gives you a new lens to look at your own financial world. Thanks for joining us on Money Psychology. The next time you make a financial decision that surprises you, whether it's an impulsive purchase or an overly cautious investment choice, ask yourself, whose voice am I hearing? And what childhood memory might be driving this choice? Understanding your money psychology doesn't guarantee better financial decisions, but it's the first step toward making choices based on your current reality rather than your childhood fears and dreams.